Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name's Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Scandal for Computer Weekly in 2009.
And my name is Nick Wallace. I wrote a book called The Great Post Office Scandal. I can't remember the name of my own book. I wrote a book called The Great Post Office Scandal, which is very nearly a year old.
So if you are at all active on Twitter or interested in the post office story in any way, you will probably have seen some information being circulated about a new play about the scandal. It's called False Accounts and it's being premiered in Birmingham at the end of October this year and then moving to London in the first week of November.
And I thought talking to the people behind that play might make a good podcast. So I suggested it to them and they said yes.
So what do you cover during the interview?
Well, all sorts of things, really. The difficulties of putting on a play in two different cities with no budget. The ethical considerations when it comes to telling other people's story, particularly victims of any particular scandal. Not getting sued by the organisations that you're writing about. And I also asked them who features in the play, because they can't... I mean, this is a story with a cast of thousands, but obviously you can't put a cast of thousands in a stage play with no budget. So have a guess, Rebecca. Who do you think are the key protagonists who appear in the play?
Alan Bates.
Well, the thing with I mean, there is an Alan Bates character.
There must be.
Yeah, there is an Alan Bates character. It's although the way that they've dealt with the sub-postmasters is to try and sort of do lots of composites, because so many sub-postmasters have, you know, lots of different horrendous things happen to them, but obviously they can't sort of do 700 cast members, so they've got five sub-postmasters, and yes, you're right, one of them is a sort of Alan Bates-ish kind of leader.
Are there multiple lawyers acting on behalf of, or do they amalgamate them as well?
Actually, that's a very good question. I didn't ask them about the lawyers, but there is Paula Venables. There is another post office employee named, and you were considered as a character. And I think you were in an early draft, but they told me that they had to. They had that issue where they had too many people on stage. So you nearly made it, Rebecca. Yeah. Nearly made it.
What about Carl? Is Carl in it?
Actually, again, didn't ask about Carl Flinders from Computer Weekly.
Who is in it then?
So, well, yeah, so you've got Paula Venables, you've got a lady called Belinda Crowe, who I think it's Belinda Crowe, who's the head of IT at the post office, one of Second Sight, Ian Henderson, and I don't think Lord Arbuthnot made the grade either.
Which does surprise me. I feel like he was so central.
Yeah, again, I think he gets a mention. But and he told, yeah, and the guy Lance, who you're about to meet, he did write a part for him, but again, it was one of those things in the workshopping process that got on the cutting room floor, very sadly. Well, look, the people behind False Accounts, the play, are a theatre outfit called Outcasts Creative, and the two people I spoke to are Suzette Pluck, who is the play's producer, and Lance Nielsen, who I just mentioned, the writer and director. And I started our chat by asking how they both met.
That's actually quite a tragic event that brought us together, because Suzette and I've this is my 15th play, and I think play number 6 or 7 I worked with an actress called Jenny. Remind me of her surname, Suzette. Jennifer.
She was Skinner at the time.
Jennifer Skinner. Yeah, yeah. I worked with an actress called Jennifer Skinner. Actually, she was in the Victoria Climbier Inquiry. That was the first play that we did together, and Jennifer and I became, you know, good friends outside of work and stayed in touch. She did two plays with me. And I lost a friend to a brain aneurysm in 2009, and an actress friend called Angela Thomas, which impacted me quite heavily, and was also the subject of a film that I did with Jason Fleming. And then by weird coincidence, Jennifer and Angela also knew each other from working on Bad Girls together. And then Jennifer passed away of exactly the same thing. I think it was in, was it 2017?
2016.
Yeah. So the first time, although Suzette and I had met in passing, the first time we met each other was actually at Jennifer's funeral.
And Jennifer was a friend of yours, Suzette?
Yeah, she's my best friend from school. Yeah. And she was the one that encouraged me and got me into performing arts and got me into college. And she was just a bright light for all of us girls. So I'd been to see her in Lance's Victoria Columbier. And yeah. from the funeral, we just sort of connected and just felt that there was something about meeting in such a raw time to maybe connect, and it then went into the lockdown. And Lance said, I'm going to be getting people to read a few scripts. Why don't you join us? Now, I wasn't an actress like Jennifer. She'd stayed with it, and I went off and had children and moved to Birmingham. And it was through the lockdown that Lance said, come and join us. And I thought, actually, that'd be a good way to be creative and not go mad in the lockdown, because I'm originally from London. And so that's how we started to, and it's just escalated since then.
So who had the idea of doing the post office story as a play? When did you both come to the conclusion that that was something you wanted to pursue?
I came up with that idea before Suzette and I even knew each other. That the germ of that started back in, I think it was either towards the end of 2009 or 2010, when I started following the story of Seema Misra, which there was a big, I don't know whether it's the Daily Mail or one of those rags, but there was a big newspaper article about, you know, postmistress thief and all this kind of thing. It was very, very one-sided. You could see what the media were doing with this particular story. And I did a play about the Victoria Columbier inquiry, and there was a lot of scapegoating in the media going on with that story in particular, involving a social worker called Lisa Arthur-Worry, who was the one that was dealing with Victoria's case when she passed away. And I just got a sense that there was that sort of manipulation going on. The thing that drew me to the story was that Seema was the dead ringer for my postmistress, who used to live around the corner from me in Hornsey. And I thought it was the same woman at first. So I confess, that was the reason I read the story. I thought, oh my God, there's my local postmistress. What's happened? But it just turned out not to be her. They just look alike. And I started following the story, and I had a sort of a germ of an idea of doing a two-handed play about two women sharing a prison cell, one of whom is completely innocent of the crime of which she's accused, which would have been the character based on Seema, and the other one you find out more as the play goes on. And that just became an idea for a play that I made a few notes for. I think I wrote a couple of scenes from reading bits and pieces in the story. And then, unfortunately, my mother got cancer, and I lost both my parents within a year of each other. And this was also around the time that Angela passed away. So there was a whole heap of other things that happened in my life, and the project just got shelved.
When did you become aware then that there was a campaign fronted by the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance to point the finger at this dodgy IT system?
So that, well, the next time I became aware of it was I read an article in Private Eye. And in fact, I think it was left in The Dentist's, you know, because I don't have a regular... I love the magazine, but I don't have a regular subscription to it. And I remember reading an article about it, and I'm pretty sure Seema's name was in it again. And I was like, that's that same story. And it wasn't long after that that the Panorama documentary was on. As soon as I'd seen the Panorama documentary, straight away I thought, right, I'm going to do a play about this at some point. But there's obviously more to come. So I just started following the story and making notes. And then the decision to actually do the play was in 2019, and Suzette was on the edge of the Outcasts at that time. We'd just done Borderlands, and I said, the next play I want to do is The Post Office Scandal. And that was before your book came out and before all the stuff came out in the High Court. But I think the writing was on the wall by then, in terms of the amount of information that I was able to get. Plus, then one of the Outcasts creative was actually somebody who manned the phones at Fujitsu on the helpline.
Yeah, I want to talk about that when we get a bit further down the line. And just before we do, I mean, Suzette, tell me about when you first heard of this scandal, because although I'd say amongst my peers it's pretty well established as now one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in legal history, you could still probably chuck a brick in most town centres and not necessarily hit someone who'd even heard of it. So when did you come across it?
I'd heard about it a few years ago, because I'm a bit nosy like that. So I just remember being intrigued by this story, and why wasn't there more furore about it? This is scandalous. And then I sort of put it down. I think in this country, we will look at something and then assume it's been sorted, because that's so bad. It must have been sorted. And it was only until Lance pulled it up again and spoke to us about it, we realised how deep it goes and how it's still ongoing. So it was I think it was a little earlier, because there's a few people around me that are still, they don't quite know what it is.
Yeah. It's been lovely seeing some of the cast members that you've hired sort of going on their own journey of discovery being actorly sort, they like to broadcast it. And so it's been interesting seeing how they've been taking on board the information as they get into the story and learn more about it.
They're extremely passionate about it. And I got to say, you know, we didn't get any funding for this play. We did look and we were too late for everything. But we felt the timing of it was right. We needed to do it now. We kind of wanted it to coincide with the public inquiry. And we didn't have a bean, and it was just like, well, you know, if we can keep the rehearsal schedule tight and we can keep the commitment tight, I think this play will be better than any showcase. So I'm sure some actors will be up for it. And the response was actually incredible. We had more people wanting to do the play than we had parts for. So the cast is probably two people too large as it is. But they've been amazing, and they're on profit share, which in real terms, when you're doing play, means, you know, you might get a drink down the pub if you're lucky. But hopefully, you know, maybe the play will get a transfer, a bigger theatre will get interested, and it might go on to bigger and greater things. We'll see. But
well, tell me about the concept then. It's called False Accounts. How big's your cast, and what's the conceit behind it? Because this is obviously, I mean, you know, when you're looking at 700 plus prosecutions, and I've had the difficulty of making films about a subject this big. Trying to transfer it to stage must be something of a headache.
It was a huge undertaking. I mean, originally the play was called The Post Office Monologues, and because I wanted to keep it simple, I knew we didn't have any money, and I thought we've got to keep the cast small. So why don't we have the story of six postmasters, and we'll have three on stage at the same time, and we'll rotate their stories. And then we decided to add Paula Venables to that, and it became a cast of seven. And then, you know, the more I was researching the story, and then some people got in touch with me and said, by the way, do you know about this that happened? And I was thinking, wow, we're letting off the bad guys pretty easily here. Yes, we're telling the story of the postmasters and the tragedy that they went through. But for the audience to be hit with that for 90 minutes, I want them to come out of the theatre thinking about more. I want them to come out of the theatre demanding answers to questions that haven't been answered yet, and I really wanted them to have a fairly broad view of who was responsible and why this had happened and the scale of it as well. So at that point I had to completely rewrite the play. Some of the monologues are still in there, and then I knew that there was going to be an ITV drama, and I thought, well, we can't write this as a straight piece, so what's the answer? And you know how it is, you're researching a subject and it's like, oh God, I found out about this. This has got to go in. This has got to go in. Well, we can't not have that. So it just became bigger and bigger and bigger. And I just didn't want to go up against the forthcoming ITV drama. Doing it as a straight play just wasn't going to work for me, because we didn't have the budget, for one thing, to do that properly. So I thought we have to do a different take on this. How can we get around it? And just the idea of doing it as a sort of dark satire, where the humour is entirely at the expense of the guilty parties, not at the expense of the victims, came to me. And I wrote one sort of comedy scene. I don't want to say which one, actually, but we sort of read that out in the acting class, and it just worked. And I thought, this is the way we've got to go, and this is going to give us a lot of leeway in terms of knowing where to point the fingers and telling people what actually happened. So and it just came together really quickly after that. I did a couple more rewrites, and then we did a read through, I think about a year ago, and it's, you know, gone through a lot of edits and things. But I'm pretty happy with it.
How do you deal with the fact that this isn't a comedy? This is a tragedy, and sure, it's an individual tragedy for so many families, and a personal tragedy for them. How do you balance that with the chosen route that you've gone down? Because I mean I understand nobody wants to go to a play and be sort of overloaded with unremitting misery, but how do you go, okay, we're going to find some laughs in this, but it's going to be respectful of the victims of this scandal?
I mean I've got a lot of experience of dealing with subjects in a similar vernacular. You know, I've tackled Hillsborough in the past, the Marchioness Inquiry, the events of Northern Ireland and all this kind of thing. And I've met a lot of the people that were involved in all of those events and attended some of their meetings and things. They always find humour in the darkest moments. There will always be something that makes them smile because they're human. That's how they get through stuff. So I tried to sort of take the same tack as that where the postmasters were concerned, without diminishing any of the impact of what they went through. That is all still there, and it's played very straight, very passionately and powerfully, I might also add, by the cast, who were brought to tears themselves during some of our rehearsals. Where I find the humour is in the rest of the play, is in the ridiculousness of what was allowed to go on. I mean, it is farcical. I mean, that's one word for it, and a polite word at that. What was allowed to happen, the scale of it, and what people got away with, and the way that they conducted themselves. That is a mine of dark humour, as I said earlier, entirely at the expense of the people responsible. And they are on the receiving end of that, and in my opinion, quite rightly so. And I think that any postmaster that comes along and watches the show, and I certainly hope that a lot of them will, I understand for some it might be quite difficult, I think they'll find that we've got the balance right in both camps. And I think they'll relate to the journey, and I hope that they'll watch it and go, my God, this is my journey, and they're telling it the right way. And that's my hope.
Suzette, what's your creative contribution to the production? Forgive me, I don't know much about the theatre world, so I don't know what a theatre producer actually does.
Neither do I. what I've been doing, because basically I'm in Birmingham, and we've got two casts, Birmingham and London, and some are crossing both productions. So I basically keep everyone calm. I'm involved with dealing with the theatre directly up here, getting everything sorted, logistics, just basically anything that can be done, and I can do it mainly from home. I'm not having to run around anywhere.
So you're the one bossing the set designers, and you're hiring the cast, and you're liaising with the theatre, and just making sure
I'm doing a little bit of everything. I leave the bossiness to Lance, because right. I want people to like me. But yeah.
Right.
But I can do, say for instance, Lance needed to get hold of an email for something, I'll get it to him in seconds. I'll try and be efficient in all the little gaps, all the little things that him and Dickon need help with. And just in the three of us holding each other up, and then we're a strong unit, then we can hold up the cast production.
Yeah, I mean, Suzette's a problem solver. A producer solves problems on a production. I mean, in a traditional sense, they normally go out and find money for a production. We don't have any. So the second role of a producer is to solve problems and make sure things don't cost us too much, or we can get things for free, like set, costumes, that kind of stuff. And I mean, one of the running jokes in the play is that we're laughing at ourselves. It's straight from the get-go, we're saying this is a production with no money, and that's actually part of the story. But we parallel that with Horizon didn't have the appropriate amount of money spent on it either, but it was still launched. And we parallel that in the play right from the get-go. So even that is relevant to the story. It's quite clever, actually, how we do that. But Suzette, to be fair to her as well, she sits in on almost every rehearsal. So, you know, we've got another opinion there and another person to contribute. And then she also gives time running lines with the actors to help them get off book. So with a team of three of us, it's pretty handy, especially as we're working with two venues and two casts.
You mentioned Paula Venables. Do you have any other real people, named people, particularly sub-postmasters, in the production? I mean, you mentioned Seema Misra as being your entry point into the story. She was my entry point into the story. Do you have Seema in the story?
Well, there are six postmasters in the play originally. We had to cut one out. There's five portrayed consistently. One actor plays two different ones. But they're called postmasters 1 to 5 in the programme. When they're referred to by name in the play, they're either called Mr. Smith or Mrs. Smith. And we clarify why that is quite early on in a scene. And it's because we didn't want to drill into only one story in particular. Let's say we based it on five real people. Well, that's five out of thousands of people that have been affected by this. But the similarities of what they went through on their journeys, although each person had different levels of tragedy and some very seriously so, there is a collective sense of the different things that went wrong. There is a collective experience. So we tell that from five different viewpoints, all of which I think will feel familiar. And there isn't anything that any one of those five characters went through that somebody didn't go through. So it's all factually accurate. I would say there are certain characters that are definitely lean towards certain people. There is, for example, one postmaster who goes to prison when they're pregnant, and they tell that story.
Which is what happened to Seema.
And that speech was in the original, you know, when I was working on the very early play, that speech was one of the first things I wrote. So it would be fair to say that, yes, one character is partially based on Seema Misra, but not wholly based.
So how do you negotiate the ethics of that? Because if you are drawing, I mean, I appreciate these stories are in the public domain, but of course the people who it happened to can rightfully or should rightfully, or perhaps might think they can rightfully claim ownership of their own stories. And even if they can't control the ownership, they might have that desire to. They might have that desire to try and control how they're represented or how they might be represented in the media. I mean, it's obviously something that I wrestle with myself as well, and have to be very careful about. I presume you didn't go to all the postmaster's stories who you've put together within these characters and ask for their permission.
No, because if you're putting bits of three or four people and maybe one of somebody else, and you know, and then the actor looks nothing like any of those people, you're basically creating a fictional character. In the same way that in some movies in the past where there have been true stories, there are often an amalgamated character that will appear who's supposed to represent four different people. A good example of that is the film JFK, directed by Oliver Stone, which is one of my favourite films of all time, I have to say. And there are various characters in that. Kevin Bacon's character is one example, who is a composite character of four people. I knew that it would be impossible. We wouldn't be able to do justice if we just told five stories of five real people and we named them. I just thought straight off the bat, even if I spoke to five people and they agreed, and even then we wouldn't have time to fit everything that happened to them. It just wouldn't be feasible. We've got very limited running time. So I think that's the job of maybe a 6 or 8 part television series to do that. We wanted to tell the collective experience of what happened to these people en masse through characters that will feel familiar, but not too familiar. And so they can say, yes, I went through that, rather than, yes, that was me.
There is one character who sort of sits above this entire story because his name's on the court documents, and he was the one who founded the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance, Alan Bates.
Yeah.
Have you had any contact with him at all? And is there a leader of the sub-postmasters within your play that people might go, I know who this is?
Well, there is a leader. He's Postmaster 5. And he has a wife that speaks to him from off stage occasionally, who we don't see. I personally wrote to Alan some time ago, never heard anything. Now, that's not necessarily his fault. I think at the time there was quite a lot going on with the JFSA. I think there was sort of court cases were coming to the fore and things were being overturned. That was right at the beginning. It might have been a year or two ago. When I started working on the new version of the script, it was the point where we said, we are going to do this. We didn't have a theatre, we didn't have any money or anything like that, but we said, we are going to do this play. And I think it was around the same time I wrote to you, actually, to let you know we were embarking on it. And I didn't hear anything. Now, it wasn't an actual email address. It was one of those little forms that you fill out. And in my experience, they're not 100% reliable. And just, I mean, even myself, I've had an email pop up now and then that somebody sent me a year ago and somehow it's gone round the houses and just suddenly appears. So email's not as infallible. But anyway, we had Chris Trousdale come on our own channel recently, who's a postmaster who is in the midst of this whole thing. Very nice man.
He was one of the first cohort of six sub-postmasters to get his conviction quashed back in December 2020.
And he came on to speak to our cast and we did like a live stream a bit like this with him. And I asked him, look, I really do want to write to Alan Bates personally, it feels very rude that we haven't managed to have that communication. And I think we just ought to write an official email to the JFSA as a whole, just saying, look, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is who we are. So actually, I sent that a couple of days ago.
How do you deal with, I mean, you've obviously had a huge amount of experience in dealing with stories, very, very difficult stories involving personal tragedies for people who might want to protect their privacy and might want ownership of their story. How do you balance that up with the wider public interest, the desire to tell a story, to make a point? Well, I mean, what if Alan Bates turned around after receiving your email 2 days ago and said, not only do I not endorse this, but I don't want you to do it?
That's a really interesting question, and it would be something I'd have to run by. That wouldn't be my decision alone, you see, because we're a team. This play isn't happening. I mean, yeah, I wrote it, but, you know, without my cast, without Dick and without Suzette's help, this play wouldn't be happening. So it's only happening because we've all jumped on board the boat and we're pulling in the same direction. Now, I already know that there's, both in on this story and others that I've worked on, there are always disagreements over, you know, who should support us and who shouldn't, and what direction we should take legally and what we shouldn't, and all the rest of it. The point is, in our modern times, this just should not have happened. Not only should it not have happened, but the thing that angers me the most, that really angers me the most, is when people knew it was happening, they still carried on sending people to prison anyway and stripping their assets and all the rest of it. How is that happening in 2022 in a modern British society? How have we allowed that to happen? And how have we allowed those people to get away with it? Why are they not in prison now? Now, I'm sorry, but those questions to me, we're talking about something that's really important for our society as a whole. You know, the human race, in fact, this is like, we're not in the 80s now where cover-ups were happening left, right and centre. We're supposed to have moved on from that. We're supposed to be better people. We're supposed to be better as a society. Yet here we are treating people like this over what? Over money, because they could steal it and take it from them. And they destroyed so many people's lives, not just the 555, but a lot of other people outside of that. I just think that the argument is so strong that the general public have to be made aware of this by any means possible. And that's the only way things are going to change, if people get so angry about it that they say, hang on a minute, this can't be allowed to go on. And the fact that they're even fudging the compensation the way they are is absolutely disgraceful.
I understand your passion for this. It's an acutely nuanced position, though, isn't it? When you say by any means necessary, that suggests that, you know, you might be prepared to tread on a few victims' toes in order to get the story out there.
I certainly don't want to do that. I just think this story is really important. It signposts so many things that are wrong with the way we're conducting ourselves today, and I mean, every one of us, we personally feel it's an honour to be able to tell this story, and we're trying to do it with the greatest level of sensitivity possible, and that's why we've structured the play we have, and that's why we've named, you know, the people that we have and haven't named the other people that we haven't. So there's a lot of care and thought that's gone into that. I didn't do this on a whim. Did think about it very, very, very carefully. And I accept that there might be some people that might come along and they might not like it. And I mean, that's the gamble with any creative arts in the realm of documentary drama, which, even though this is a dark satire, it still is a documentary drama. And you always have to take that risk. And there is that element of risk. And I think as a creative, you have to accept that level of risk. But if you've done your due diligence and care of duty on the subject matter, and shown a great level of sensitivity, which I believe we have, I think that those impacted will like it.
Yeah, no, I think from the perspective of being on street level and people on the street, the lack of knowledge about a system that was put into law-abiding people's work spaces for a company that many have grown up with and was just a beautiful energy. The post office, a beautiful energy. I think for us to, a lot of those people have been walking around in deep shame and trying to get people to believe what they went through and trying to explain it was the computer that did it. And people were like, oh, yeah, okay. But for us to give them the real facts, for them to have all the information and almost alleviate some of the pressure they've been under, because, you know, the story's been told, but unless you show an interest in it, you can, and it doesn't, if it doesn't impact on you, people will politely go on their way. And the politeness is always relied upon because then no one makes a fuss and then people get away with it. So I think for us to tell the story on the behalf of us as humans that are living under a system which we've trusted for so long, I think it's important that we get to be a voice for those people, because many of them have been muted in a sense.
I think that's a really interesting point. And to take both of your answers together, the success of your project will be down to its quality. You are going into difficult territory if you are trying to raise laughs out of a scandal with the best of intentions. It has to be funny. It has to be, you know, in context is everything.
If
it's going to land, if it's going to strike a chord, it has to be a thing of exceptional quality, which, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. But I really do think there's something really interesting about satire being able to say the unsayable. You, as a journalist, and as you see politicians and you see lawyers as well, who sort of trip over themselves with their politesse sometimes, there is potentially an opportunity for you to say the unsayable in public, which would strike a chord with many sub-postmasters who, you know, you can read them on Twitter, outraged at what has happened, desperate to know why people aren't in prison yet, very, very angry. And so, yeah, I can see this could go a number of ways. And of course, you're not going to be able to please everyone all the time, are you?
No, I mean, I just do want to say that the least objective is, in certainly in my mind when I was writing it, was writing for cheap laughs. That wasn't the goal. The goal was, if we do this as a satire, it really comes back to what you just said. We can take more risks and we can say things that we couldn't say if it was a straight play and we had to play everything straight.
But the converse of that is that if you go for easy targets in satire, it's not funny. So you have to stretch yourselves, don't you, to find the right target to land on. And I imagine there's, you know, there are some easy hits. There are always some easy
hits.
The
post office has provided us with ample more targets than we knew what to do with, really, in this. And for Jitsu too.
Where have you found your source material? Where's the richest seam that you've mined?
After the Panorama program, what I did was look for individual names of stories. Seema was obviously the first one that I read, and I had a waft of documents and links and things on her. And then there was another lady called Jo
Hamilton,
thank you. There's parts of her story in one of our postmasters, but that character, I think, is a mix of bits of Jo Hamilton, bits of a lady called Nicola Arch, bits of another lady. But there were always things, there were always just little things that were, oh, yeah, that's, we've got to have that, you know, in this character. I think there was one lady whose mother died when they were in prison. And she mentions in her speech, do you remember when that happened in COVID and you know, you lost your parent and you couldn't go to their funeral? So a lot of it came from those little, the core of the play, because don't forget at the beginning, the play was called The Post Office Monologues, and it was just all the postmaster's voices. So it was all those little stories, the little stories I could find online initially. And then when we started getting the bigger picture articles, you know, from Computer Weekly, and started finding out about Fujitsu. See, I didn't even know that a separate company was involved in doing the software for quite some time. That until the Panorama program, I didn't really have a clear depiction of how that all worked. And so then you just realized the story was so big, we had to change it up. And then, so there were two things that happened later on. One was we had somebody who's actually part of the Outcast Creative, who used to man the helplines, and they quit their job because it was so emotionally soul destroying. But they were on that phone line.
This is the Fujitsu Horizon helpline.
That's correct. Yeah, they were on that. One of our actors was on that helpline. I don't want to say their name or anything like that, but
forgive me, because this is a slightly technical question. Was it first or second or third level support?
They were frontline.
Right. Okay. So they were the. I mean, because there's all sorts of stories about the scripts that they had to read from, and that they often weren't that more technically trained than the postmasters themselves.
Completely untechnically trained. In fact, we pick up on that aspect in the play, because we have a whole scene about the helpline with three different people on the helpline, and we explore exactly how much training they had, and that's three quotes from three people directly.
Why did you say that they packed it in?
Oh, they found it too emotionally distressing, because they actually really wanted this person in particular, and I know them fairly well, so this would definitely be in their nature. They actually genuinely wanted to help these people, and it started impacting them. They were having trouble sleeping. You know, when you know you're going into work to a job you hate every day, or that you know something's going to go wrong, which I imagine was how a lot of the sub-postmasters felt, you know, what's going to go wrong with the books today? This was the same thing for this young individual, and they were quite young, at least compared to us. They, you know, said that it was impacting their life outside of work. You know, they were constantly thinking about it because the people they were dealing with were in such a state of distress. So you're taking 10, 15 calls like that a day with people of equal level of distress. It's a bit like working for the Samaritans without having the proper training that you should have if you're going to work for the Samaritans.
That's really interesting. Suzette, what's your favourite part of the play in terms of the way you've seen it coming together? What's been the joy in this, or for you, or the creative satisfaction?
Oh, for me, I've always loved acting, but I've never been really on the other side. So in this part of my life, the older years, the wealth of information I've picked on what it is to be human, watching the actors doing the monologues and then just seeing moments where you can add a little bit of human or get them to think about what would that feel like? Where would you place your hand at that point when you've just said that particular thing? Getting involved in the creative and fleshing out the characters so that they do justice, so that the audience is impacted, they feel raw, they feel emotional. They almost feel a little bit like, well, I didn't know it was this bad. But then watching the other part of it where the satire comes in and they almost get an instant gratification that those are the people that did that to them and we sort of pull them apart. So just watching it all coming together, the actors become more confident in themselves and the scenes, the understanding of what the scene is, all of that is what's the draw for me, and to make sure that the people that watch it, the sub-postmasters and postmasters that were impacted by it, getting a real sense of, oh, this is more than a play. This is somebody's written down.
I mean, the cast who are playing the postmasters, and our cast is very much two halves. We've got the people playing the bad guys on one side and the postmasters and what I would call the whistleblowers on the other side. And, you know, the cast that are playing the postmasters, without exception, you can see how not only how seriously they're taking it in terms of their level of performance and their professionalism, but it is impacting them. You know, they are... So, and we keep, if we find out little things we didn't know before, we try and put them in. I mean, like the thing about the police contract with Fujitsu, that's gone into the play now because we
sorry
that,
the what sorry
Fujitsu have won the contract because no one else bid for it.
Oh, the police national database. Yes.
Yeah. So we thought, well, that's got to go in. So we can't let that not have a mention. So it's in there and it's in the right place. But, you know, because they know what they're doing is real. It's not, we're not doing a four-handed play about relationships or whatever. This is serious stuff. And they are very affected by it, but very dedicated because of that, without exception.
How do you avoid preaching to the choir? Because you've got to have some kind of dramatic tension in this. And you've obviously sort of... because this story is well known by many of the people who will come and see it, and because it's been played out in the public arena, we know the ending, as it were, even though it isn't over. But how do you stop sort of repeatedly punching the post office in the face? Because that can get tiresome after a while.
I think there's more here than just the post office. I mean, we talk about Fujitsu. You know, there's a character based on a couple of people who worked at Fujitsu. So one of our other contacts was somebody who worked at Fujitsu at a high level. And we got quite a bit of information out of them. And I mean, they're, as far as I'm concerned, they're as culpable. You know, I mean, they started the whole mess to begin with. And, you know, you don't send a ship out to sea with holes in it. You just don't. And that's what
I do take the point that there are sort of lots of targets in this, not just the post office, in terms of the government, civil servants, as well as Fujitsu. But how do you make sure that there's some kind of dramatic tension in a play like this?
Well, apart from the preaching to the converted, the people that are coming to see it, like Suzette said, the average person on the street, because we're always asking the question, have you heard of the Horizon post office scandal? And is that where, you know, all those people got robbed or something? And the answer is always extremely vague. People don't really know what it's about. Mm. And we're trying to educate people and give them an overview of what happened from start to finish. And I think for the average theatre goer, this will be a very gripping, almost unbelievable piece of theatre, because there's nothing in the play that didn't happen in reality. There are some funny, silly moments at certain people's expense and things like that. But there's, you know, as far as the factual events are concerned and the facts that we impart to the audience, they're all completely true. So, you know, I think for someone who doesn't know much about this story, they're going to come out and they're going to want to research it, and they're going to want to find out more, and they're going to want to look at the documentaries. They're going to want to buy your book because it could happen to them. As Suzette said, it's a national institution that's always been there. You know, and you wonder if you had an account, for example, with the post office, but you weren't particularly diligent at checking your money. It makes you think back, God, were there times when money went missing from my account? Because that could have happened as well, now that I've looked into all the different types of bugs that there were.
Tell me why you decided to put the play on in both Birmingham and London. Because that's quite ambitious, isn't it, for a first stab at something?
Well, actually, that was always going to be what we were going to try and do, because we have two acting classes that we run. Suzette runs the Outcast Creative in Birmingham, and me and Dickon run the one in London. And it was supposed to be the first play where we had actors from both classes coming together to do a show. And that was originally the idea behind it. And at first we were just going to do Birmingham, and we were going to look for a London venue for next year. But then the Questors Theatre in Ealing offered us a week. And we just thought, well, you know, it's actually probably easier to do the two shows closer together, because we'll have the momentum, and there are some actors. I think there's four actors that are in both casts, four or five. It just sort of came together, really. And I mean, also, you know, these are very short runs. We've got four nights in Birmingham. We've got five nights in London. That's only nine altogether. I think we might get an extra matinee or two if the tickets sell really well. And they're doing okay, and we don't have a big PR machine, so we're dependent on people like yourselves to, you know, give us a shout out. That's a good length to test it out. And I think you know, if we were able to get it on in a bigger venue for a longer run, there's a few things with it I'd probably do a little bit differently, because we'd have more time, we'd have presumably we'd have a budget to play with, you know. So, but yeah, no, I mean, this way we've both got contacts in both areas, and this way I think it's good for the people who are interested in the story, because this is a national story. I mean, you know, ideally I'd love to have a week of it in Wales and a week of it in Scotland and a week of it in Ireland, because, you know, especially when you listen to the testimony at the public inquiry, which all my actors have watched, at least, you know, some of those, these heartbreaking stories. They're from all over the place. So I think we felt from the off it was good to make it more accessible to people as well as our own objectives.
It's a great idea. And just while you're mentioning the public inquiry, the public inquiry website has all the testimony from the sub-postmasters who took part in the oral sessions of the human impact hearings. And I challenge anyone to watch more than 5 or 6 of those in a row without being stopped short. It's incredible.
I could watch 2 or 3 of them in one go, tops. And there were some little bits of some of those people's stories who I'd never heard before. We added a bit here and a bit there to flesh out some of our characters. And there was I think it was an Egyptian gentleman who gave evidence.
Sami Sabet,
yeah. And I copied the link for his testimony and I said to all the cast, you've got to watch this guy.
That's really interesting because he was the one who struck me. I was in the room when he was speaking. And,
right.
Immediately afterwards, I went up to him and I said, look, can we swap numbers? That was some of the most extraordinary testimony that I've ever heard. And Sammy's an amazing guy. I've done some stuff on stage with him in the South Coast where he lives. And yeah, he is a guy who he's a proud man, as all the sub-postmasters are, but he was just utterly broken by a system that he trusted in and believed in. And the way he articulates what he was put through, I think is, you know, in a, you know, all of these stories are affecting, but his really struck with me as well. That's very interesting.
Well, one of our actresses, Kathy Oda Sanya, who's playing a woman of African descent, and she watched another one of the ladies who gave testimony. I'm reaching for the name again, but she has based her performance partly on that lady. And her brother is actually a dead ringer for Sammy. And Kathy's brother was originally, he's part of Outcast Birmingham, and he originally was in the show. And I wanted to add a sixth postmaster because I was so affected by that testimony. And it was so unique. It was a very different journey that he'd been through. And he, like you said, his perspective on it was just different. It was, but no less moving than in any others. And I thought, God, we've got to have a character based on this guy. And I did actually write it. But I didn't want that character in the show if we didn't have the right actor to play him. And then Kathy's brother had to drop out because he has to be in Malta around the time of the performances. So that was the sixth postmaster that got cut. But yeah, I mean, all of our cast have watched at least 2 or 3 of those.
What's it like watching 2 different actors interpreting one of the parts? So if you've got a different actor in Birmingham to a different actor in London interpreting one specific part, what's that like as a producer, Suzette, watching that happen?
For me, it actually all is about the energy. If they don't believe it, or they're not bringing the energy of the words to life, then it doesn't matter if they've got different accents or their slight difference in appearance. For me, it's each time I hear the words, I need to be able to believe you. And that's what brings the character. So they may be playing them slightly differently. You've got different accents in some cases, but it's all about the energy that they bring those words to life and impact the audience, and they could be running it very different ways, and the same actor could maybe run the dialogue differently, but each time they have to commit to the character and the energy they're trying to convey.
I understand you've got a Fujitsu employee who is played with, as you say, 2 different accents, but both actors are getting something out of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's an actor who's relatively new to the Outcast called Shaz Ali, who's this will be his first experience of acting on stage ever. And the actor, and he's playing in the London cast, he's playing Fujitsu IT and no other role. So he could just purely focus on getting that right. And I actually wrote the part specifically with him in mind when I wrote it. And we've had contact with a couple of different ex-employees of Fujitsu. And I sort of amalgamated again, and they were both from very different backgrounds. So his interpretation of the character is completely different from Graham McDonnell, Graham McDonald, who's a much more experienced actor, is playing about seven parts. He's playing Fujitsu IT. He's also playing Belinda Crowe with a wig on. And
Belinda Crowe is what, the head of IT at the post office?
Yes.
Apparently, around 2013. Is that right?
During some very key moments, and was also present at some very important meetings.
I don't want to give away too much, but I'm now very intrigued by who you've got in your cast. So you've mentioned Paula Venables, you've mentioned Fujitsu IT, you've mentioned Belinda Crowe. Are the roles for the politicians, the Lord Arbuthnots of this world, and Second Sight, and those guys?
Ian Henderson is in there, and Ron Warmington gets mentioned. We couldn't have them both, so we went with Ian Henderson. There's a fantastic actor playing him called Alan Wales, who actually I was rehearsing with right before we did this interview, and I was rehearsing with him online doing his Henderson speeches. So we have Henderson in there. James Arbuthnot gets mentioned in the play. I think he gets mentioned two or three times. He's not in the play. He was in an earlier draft where I had a kind of little speech he gave in the House of Commons. And that, but you know, I think our first act is 1 hour, 5 to 10 minutes, and our second act is between around 55 minutes. That's really as long as we felt the play could be. And it doesn't drag. I mean, there's always something going on, and it cracks along quite nicely. But
I suppose you have to guard against the audience going, well, who's this? And who's this?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to overload them with characters. I mean, at one point, you know, we even have a character say, look, I know we're jumping around in the timeline a bit, but could we just talk about blah, blah? So whenever we are doing that, we clearly underscore that we are, because it's as you said, it's a very, very complex story with a lot of moving parts that requires a great deal of sensitivity. But you also want to be able to point the finger and say, this person really should have done this. This person really should have done this. This person's job was to do this. Why didn't they do that job?
And I think the audience will see, won't they, as well? It will stand out to them. They just will just know how wrong it was based on the characters, how Lance has written it. That it's absurd.
I mean, you're both obviously very passionate. Where, Suzette, would you like to see this play go? What would you like to see it achieve?
For me personally, I would like for the invisible ones, you know, to fall to battle and have maybe the backing of your family, maybe some of the community, but would never understand what it is to walk down the street and people believe that you've stolen vast amounts of money. And the impact it's then had on them, had on their children, and the widespread impact. I just want those people to feel heard, that they haven't gone mad, they're not crazy. There are people that are not connected, that don't need to be connected, that have chosen to commit their time and energy into believing them and giving their story a voice. I'd like it to, like Lance would like to see it move around, so that people can take a breath, because it's horrendous what's happened. It's horrendous, and they need to be heard, I feel.
I mean, you know, I don't know whether the Edinburgh Festival would be the right place for it, because generally that's a traditional one-act play venue, and it's quite hard to get people to stay after an interval for a two-act play when there's 900 other plays they've got to go and see. But in the same token, because this story is so big and it's impacted so many people, there's part of me that thinks it might do quite well there. But it would be really great, you know, we're all hard-working, grafting creatives who don't have the backing of an institution. We haven't come up through the gravy train, and it would be good to see some of these national institutions and the big players come and support a company like ours who've done this with nothing, and give us, you know, the means and a vehicle to take it to a bigger stage and thus a wider audience. Because like your book, it's a story that deserves the widest audience possible, the widest readership possible. And for me, that's the primary goal, is that as many people get to hear about this story as possible. And that, you know, before myself even, I would like to see my actors get paid for their efforts as well, because they're all giving their time for free, which I constantly remind them that I'm very grateful for. And we're all so broke at the minute, I can't even afford to buy them a glass of wine, you know.
Let's get the plugging in then. Tell us the name of the theatre in Birmingham, because that's the first run. How much tickets are going for and where people can find them?
So it's the Old Joint Stock Theatre, Birmingham. Suzette will read out the website in a second.
Yeah, when does your run start in Birmingham?
It's the 18th. Is it the 19th? 19th of October to the 22nd.
Producer's got it tattooed on the inside of it.
I think if we sell out, I think if we sell out before we open, they're going to give us one day early. So we might go up a day early, but 19th to the 22nd. So we're Wednesday through to Saturday there.
Old Joint Stock.
And it's above a pub in the centre of Birmingham. Very easy to get to from all the stations and trams and things. But it's not your typical theatre above a pub. It's two levels above, and it's actually a really beautiful space. Beautiful, you know, the actors have even got a green room. I mean, I know. And there's a separate bar up there. You can't hear the other pub at all. It's really lovely. And then in London,
your pre-arranged West London transfer.
Yeah, it's the Questors Theatre, which is a theatre that I have, not that I performed there before, but I used to. It's the first theatre that my parents took me to when I was younger, because my mum and dad knew people that were in plays. There was a guy called Tony Rigglesworth who used to direct plays there, and we used to go and see all his plays. So it's quite nice that that's come full circle for me.
And the dates of that are?
We're 1st to the 5th of November. Closest tube is Ealing Broadway. It's the Questors, I think it's the questorstheatre.co.uk. Just Google Questors Theatre, false accounts. And again, they may also give us a matinee if we sell out. What we want to do is try and sell the shows out before they even open. It's great for the cast. It'll really help us with a transfer. And, you know, everybody that's worked on the show deserves it. And I think it's... Although it's about a serious subject, I think people are going to have... We've got the level of content right. I think you're going to have a good night out, but at the same time, you're going to be educated on a very serious subject. But we don't want you to walk away too depressed, because otherwise people will just want to forget everything.
Yeah.
I think if you go at people, if you go at them, this is happening, you need to look, they be traumatised and they're like, I don't need that in my life, we've been through enough.
Yeah, no one wants to get beaten over the head with a subject, do they?
Yeah, soften the blow so it's not just a stark story.
And I was quite conscious of that, about how do we get that right, and I think we've done a pretty good job with it.
That was Lance Nielsen, the writer and director, and with him was Suzette Pluck, producer of False Accounts, Exposing the Post Office Cover-Up.
And in case you missed it, as it did get a little garbled towards the end, the play is being performed at the Old Joint Stock Theatre in Birmingham from the 19th to the 22nd of October, and at the Questors Theatre in Ealing, London, from the 1st to the 5th of November.
Thanks very much for listening to episode 13 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. This podcast is written, produced, paid for and edited by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace. We are supported with wisdom and expertise by Whistledown Productions.
I am in their studio right now and I am very grateful.
We'll be back with more soon.
See you next time.
Bye.